Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thanks for going back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by a very lively Nick Osello and Larkin Kemp as we are recording with about 9 minutes to go in Virginia versus Georgetown, the finale of what has been at times a unbelievable and at other times a very ho-hum first round of the NCAA tournament. The Georgetown Hoyas currently lead 10-9, and Virginia went off sides. They continue their array of wild turnovers that have cost them a ton of opportunities and a great save by Jake Merrick. But he gives up the ground ball, waved off. This is unbelievable. I think this is going to be a whistle because of an injured Virginia player. And that AP is my expectation going to go to Virginia. Fellas, I don't know if it's a good idea that we're recording while the game is going on, but we've had tremendous success with this in the past. Nick, how you doing, bud?
I'm doing fantastic. And for the listeners out there, Larkin and I are about 30 seconds ahead of Terry. So you're going to hear Larkin and I scream and then Terry scream at an indeterminate amount of time later. I wasn't able to catch the first half of this because I went to a PLL junior watch party. Congratulations to Easton Blanchard from Middleton, Idaho, going to the PLL Water Dogs junior. So missed the first half of this game, but it takes a community, Terry, and you got to show up for your community. To my dad, sorry, I just quoted Hillary Clinton. To my sisters, aren't you proud that I just quoted Hillary Clinton? Larkin, how you doing?
Wow, that was well done. A little bit of pop at Osello today. Wow. I'm doing great. Happy Mother's Day. I just had an incredible dinner with my mom, and thankful for all the lacrosse moms out there. So excited to talk some ball. We'll see how this one finishes.
Before we get into the men's lacrosse, you're currently wearing a Stanford Cardinal sweatshirt. You were a volunteer assistant for that team last year, and they advanced to the NCAA quarterfinals with a win over Michigan. Very dramatic. Were you able to get eyes on that matchup?
I was. The stream didn't work for about a quarter and a half. Not enough money, I guess, at the University of Michigan. You know, can't make ESPN work. That's tough. If that had been a men's game, I think Twitter would have burned down. But massive goal late by Leah Pitsky to tie, and Jordan Case with the winner. So congrats to the Stanford Cardinal. First ever quarterfinal. They go to Chapel Hill.
Nikki, give us an update.
Unbelievable trip, flag down. Everybody stopped, and something happened after that, Terry. I'll just let you watch because I don't want to spoil what happened, but howdy-doody.
While we wait for that to come to fruition, so the outline from best games to least best games is probably the fairest way to put it. We're going to talk about Syracuse's 16-15 win over Yale, Hopkins' 9-8 OT win over Cornell, Duke's 14-12 win over Richmond. We're probably going to talk about this game at the end, although I don't know. I don't know what is happening.
Terry, don't miss that goal. Did you just watch that goal? Don't miss it.
Dude, unbelievable.
Okay, you guys have had an opportunity to see the replay a couple times. Larkin, can we get a recap here?
So, two-man game, top of the box, right alley. They throw through X, hit the crash follow. Effectively, three Virginia players close on a slipping Georgetown player.
Jack Ransom.
I don't even know how to describe, you know, his evasion, but flagged down on a, what looked like maybe a cross check, and then he buries it low and away. It appears that they're playing at the Bell Center on ice because both teams have the wrong cleat length. That's the only way I can describe this game. I can't even imagine. Look at the wing. The wing just tripped again. I can't even imagine trying to play short 60 midfield against ACC athletes while wearing hockey skates. That's basically what we're watching.
Jack Ransom, incredible. That looked like a play where the defense thought that the whistle had blown and stopped playing, and the offensive player was like, well, might as well take this shot. It was kind of like how you remember when Kevin Garnett used to go up and block everything just out of principle during the Ubuntu Celtics run, and but the offensive version of that. So we're going to talk about this game whenever it's over. Right now it is shaping up to warrant top billing, and it is indeed getting that. But we can't do a full analysis until it is fully complete. Larkin did hit on what has been one of the important topics, which is nobody can stay on their own 2 feet in this one. We're also going to touch a little bit on Penn State's 10-6 win over Army and Carolina, Notre Dame, and Princeton.
Really quickly, how ridiculous this is.
Go ahead.
This is like when the U.S. Ryder Cup postmortem came out and they were like confused about the speed of the greens and the rough length. Like, Virginia is at home. They could quite literally cut the grass to any length they want and not tell Kevin Warren about it. So for Virginia's cleats to be unprepared to play here is like literally insane. Can we all agree on that?
We can agree on that. I want to know what the form versus function of this is. Are we not wearing more effective cleats because there are only 3 grass fields in college lacrosse, or because cleats that actually stick into the ground don't look cool? That's what I want to know.
Good question.
All right.
We have to start talking games.
Let's go to the Dome.
This has been a disaster of an intro, but I love it.
Let's go to the Dome. I can lay this one out. I just finished the game story on this one. Ultimately, what it comes down to was a game of runs. John Mullen scored 6 seconds into the game. Syracuse scored the second goal. Looked like they were going to roll. Yale responded with a quick two. It was 3-2 after the first quarter. Yale really couldn't get any offense going from their attack in the first half. It was all out of the midfield. So the likes of Luke Pascal and Cole Jackson and Cole Cash in, you know, whereas I felt like it was a pretty standard operating procedure, offensive performance out of the orange again there in the first half. But ultimately, the Bulldogs scored the last 4 goals of the second in order to take a 2-goal halftime lead. Syracuse responded with 3 straight to open the third, and it was really an indicator of Ben Freeman going cold. He finished with just 6 saves, and he, I believe, let in 8 or 9 straight goals between the third and the fourth quarter. Syracuse looked like they were going to be able to salt this one away. They were up 16-12 with 6 minutes to go. That's when Joey Spallina, who finished with 2-2, scored his second goal. But the Bulldogs had answered every punch that Syracuse had thrown and scored 3 straight of their own to cut it to 16-15. Mullen, who finished 22 of 33 facing off, picked up 18 of his own ground balls, went early on the final faceoff of the game to set up Yale's final opportunity. There was a deflected shot. Cole Cashin gets the loose ball and throws an incredible around the world, only for Jimmy McCool to get his foot on it, making his 17th save of the game. And ultimately, that was the difference. Plus 11 in the save category, plus 1 on the scoreboard. And this generational team that brought the energy, the juice back to the Dome has their season alive. They win their final game in the Carrier Dome. And now Joey Spallina and Michael Leo get a home game as they take on North Carolina at Hofstra in one of the 2 quarterfinals. I don't believe we know the times of Saturday's quarterfinals yet, but the other game will be Notre Dame versus Johns Hopkins. Larkin, you got anything on this one?
Yeah, it's one I had soft-circled all week as a huge trap game for the Orange. Yale's really been trending. Anyone who goes back and watches the Army-Yale film from February as a, you know, juxtaposed to the way those young kids grew up this year, to me, Andy Shea is probably the national coach of the year. They are playing a myriad of young talent at both attack and offensive midfield. And over the last 6 weeks, I'm not sure you could find a group that's outperformed more. They did everything right. The only other KPI that you didn't reference was they also lost the faceoff battle, right? So this is a game where 6v6, you know, Yale frankly probably deserved to win. It goes back to what we talk about consistently, which is the Syracuse Orange have mojo in upstate, man, whether it's the crowd, whether it's the refs, whether it's the Dome and the tradition, but they're very, very hard to beat even when they get outplayed in that building. All of that goes away. Now this is a team that needs to find themselves. And to give the glass half full argument, they're still hyper talented. They can draw leverage, and Gary, you know, March and Odierna are going to have their full attention this week, right? They got outplayed in their own building by a really young group. We're going to touch on the heels in a second. It's a colossal matchup. Who knows about Duffy's availability, et cetera. But, for all of those who thought they would skate their way to Hofstra, certainly didn't do that. So credit to the Bulldogs and a good year for them.
Liam Connor just put the Hoyas up 12-9 with 4 minutes and 9 seconds to go. Nick, what do you got on the Orange keeping their season alive?
It would be so huge if Virginia's out. I thought they were the scariest team going in. I thought this was a great a great matchup because it seemed like what we had been talking about with Syracuse for 4 years and their gradual ascension to a Memorial Day weekend. Yale had almost completed that same four-year arc Syracuse has been on in one season. And well to said. Larkin's point, if Yale won this one, I would have put them at kind of the upper echelon of Vegas odds to take home the title. This is a scary team, and I think that this was a pass torching or a passing of the torch. Pass torching. Nice one, Nick.
I like pass torching. Just run with it.
Yeah, pass torching. From Syracuse being the team loaded with talent that people are excited about to Yale. Ultimately, I couldn't agree with Larkin more that if this was just a pure game of 6-on-6, that Yale wins. And, you know, when we are able to take a step back and look at stats, I don't think it's surprising that Syracuse needed a goaltender matchup win. And especially in that first half, the faceoff win, ultimately the deciding factors. My big takeaway from this game, and I was just giving, you know, Yale kind of its just desserts. Syracuse, to me, has just still not been able to figure out consistent offense. There were some flashes of brilliance, and then there were a couple possessions that, quite frankly, were head-scratchers. College lacrosse players are not PLL players, and you can't rely on college athletes, no matter how skilled they are, to consistently make behind-the-back skip passes or, you know, making the hero play. It just seems like Syracuse's plan is to have a degree all-in moment, rush the shooter on every single possession. And it's just an untenable consistency. And I think when, when/if Syracuse gets bounced, it's just going to go back to what is the offensive identity other than heroes making heroic plays.
So, to me, the most heroic hero is Finn Thompson. I think that while that might have been an Ether-esque take with the attention that Spelina has gotten over the course of the last 4 years, I think Thompson has been thought of as a finisher. But with a 3-goal, 2-assist performance in this one, I thought that as a facilitator and as a overall hinge, he really separated himself in a way that was super impressive. Also, you cannot leave Michael Leo and Luke Roa hands-free from anywhere inside of 15 yards. I felt like that was whenever those guys were stepping into their shots, that was when Syracuse was getting consistent offense. And when they weren't, and it was interesting because one of the most anomalous elements of the box score was Peyton Anderson with 3 assists. And I think back to it and I was like, his alley dodging got the defense moving in a way that was effective, but I wouldn't have guessed that he had 3 assists based on the way that the game unfolded. Whereas I thought that Yale's offense, what was so interesting is when you looked at highlight clips of their goals, so many of them were long ISO dodges, clear outs, no slide come, just shot on the run. And when you watched them play over the course of the game, there was a lot of pick action. There was a lot of really good ball movement. And the dichotomy was really interesting insofar as, you know, what do you want to get? How do you try to create it? And how do you try to create it consistently and sustainably? Ultimately, to your point, Nick, I think that it was unovercomable, right? The goaltending and faceoff disadvantage were too much to be overcome. And that was what determined the outcome of the game. But I also think that, you know, Larkin, to your point, there's going to be a lot to learn on film for this group, and they'll turn their attention to North Carolina, which, you know, I guess we can just talk about right now. 24-6 winners over Albany. Dom Petromala, 10 goals. The most dramatic elements of the game happened before the game started when Owen Duffy was confirmed to be out with a lower body injury that was sustained in the second half of the ACC championship game loss to this Virginia squad last Sunday. And then not only that, but also they replaced their goalie. Freshman Josh Marcus, who had started all season, was replaced with Kent Good, who came in and played pretty well. Ultimately, I don't think there was that much to take away from this game. I felt like Albany really lacked juice in a way that was super disappointing. You know, if we're going to contrast this against Jacksonville and Marist's performance, I felt like both those teams' compete level was degrees of magnitude higher than Albany's. And, you know, Silas Richmond had been struggling with injuries. This was an Albany team that lost to Yale 15-2 like 20 days ago. So in that way, these weren't shocking elements. But if I'm North Carolina, like, this was a game that, aside from all the records that we set, I'm going to forget by Tuesday, if not already. So, Larkin, as you spin forward, what are your thoughts on a Syracuse-Carolina matchup?
I think that it's a huge advantage that Bresch was able to settle in his freshman dynamic midfielders, effectively playing what is like an intramural practice. No disrespect. I have a ton of respect for the Albany coaching staff and that team, but the truth is like they weren't prepared to play, you know, and that is a colossal advantage. So I think the only piece I want to call out from this game, I reference the bracket and seeding all the time throughout the year. And frankly, I think for most fan that probably just goes directly over their head. Think about the delta in the matchup as the 3 seed versus the 4 seed this weekend. We're going to get into it in a few minutes, I'm sure. But the quality, the level of the quality opponent, the amount you leave out there in terms of like what it takes out of your, you know, fuel tank, let's call it, and ability to look forward and have your coordinators start working on film for the next matchup. You know, everything that goes into it. Like you get to rest Duffy. Would Duffy have played if they had, you know, received a higher quality opponent, right? All these different things. So, you know, it's a very unique sport in that the bracket is small and the violence of the variance between the opponent you receive, if you're the 1, 2, 3 seed versus everybody else, is just ginormous.
Game.
I fast forwarded during the commercial, so now and I'm even with you boys now. Nick, can you tell us what's happened while Larkin was talking?
So Georgetown was up 13-9.
They were up 12-9. They were up 12-9 when Larkin was talking.
They were up 12-9, yeah. Virginia's going full court press. Georgetown scores one. What just happened was Virginia full court press kind of off the faceoff, and they were doing a good job of it. Charlie McGurran, deep hole, just shot it from his own restraining line, buckets. I've been wanting to say this is over for Virginia, but given how their season has unfolded, I've been hesitant to say it. But I think Georgetown walks into Charlottesville. The fans are leaving. Have they not watched? There's 3 minutes left.
To the exits.
Fans are leaving.
To the exits. This
what
is
are they doing? Oh,
Larkin,
man.
Your thoughts.
I think it's just a really good reminder that someone like Kevin Warren, someone like John Tillman, people who have the ability to prepare and specifically a defensive midfield culture. Remember, Georgetown postponed games, right, against Hopkins and Loyola. They lost most of the other big games on their schedule. What do they have? They have a culture of toughness and chunk and run compete level that is willing to look the Millens in the eye, willing to look the Dunkels in the eye and say, come get us. You guys are the hottest team in college across. We've been doing this a long time. And we're not really afraid of freshmen and sophomores. We get it. You're 5 stars. We get it. Your dad was really good. But let's see if you can beat us, right? So when I saw this matchup, and remember, I obviously have a relationship with Lars, and weirdly, I like started defending him this year, frankly, which was an unfair position the nation put me in. But yeah, this was one where I thought Georgetown could easily come in and sneak this out. Big time.
Robbie Hopper gets one back, 2:45 to go. Georgetown wins it forward and throws the ball out of bounds. So Virginia's going to get an opportunity here. These two teams played in the fall, and afterward, Lars said to the covering press that Georgetown was going to be a Final Four team and they were going to be playing in their stadium, Scott Stadium, because this was just after the host site had been awarded, and that I've heard two versions of this. One was that Virginia was going to be parking cars, and the other was that they were going to be bringing Georgetown Gatorade. So incredibly ironic matchup, and we get a turnover, ball going back to the Hoyas here with 2:22 to go.
Oh, my God. Virginia just terrified to make a play and not commit a stupid mental mistake. This is insane. I was really worried about Virginia coming into this. Huge. Congratulations to Georgetown.
Virginia got super flat-footed in their backside movement, in my opinion. Like, this is one where the fourth, fifth, sixth offensive threats, like, were not ready to play. If you clip the game, they allowed Georgetown to force them into two-man phone booths, like, way too consistently, and a Kevin Warren coach team is going to win those matchups every time, right? They're going to switch picks and, you know, make you win.
I talk about it all the time. A 12-8 game is really hard to evaluate because you can make the argument that the defense didn't do enough or the offense didn't do enough. This is a 14-10 game, which on a margin is the same, and but in total is different. So, Larkin, it kind of sounds like, you know, when you're looking at it from a 60-minute basis, you're focused on the fact that Virginia should be outscoring the Hoyas. Is that right?
Not just outscoring, but like bullet point one when you sit down to write a memo of how to beat a John Tillman coaching tree is you got to get low fills involved. And you got to get high and away help involved. So, like, we need to make guys like Nick Osello, who are super athletic, not particularly sharp, make fill decisions that are, like, 15 yards away, right? And Virginia just didn't do that tonight. Like, if you just clip the game, there's three guys standing in the far alley while Brennan dodges with Dunkel, and that's a two-man with only one guy hedge.
That was mean.
Yeah, it was. That was a mean chirp. I'm going tonight. I apologize. I'm fired up. I'm going to get going on Richmond here shortly. But look at Kevin Warren, man. I mean, look at this. I don't know if you guys
He's still so pissed.
This is a full Nick Saban clip. He's up four with 70 seconds to go in a game that Vegas had him dead to rights, and he is literally going ballistic because they're not executing a double down, which is when, you know, effectively Virginia's going to have to press late, empty net. Because he's a detailed-oriented mother effer, and that's why he's in a real conference. He's not playing in, like, the A-Sun, and he's won eight conference tournaments in a row in a conference that Denver is pretty darn good most years.
One of the themes that I thought emerged this weekend was individual efforts versus team play, particularly in Duke-Richmond, and from what I've seen of this game, I wasn't able to watch most of the first half. But it seems – you know, prevalent in Hopkins Cornell as well. Who's relying on the individual efforts and the playmakers, and who came ready to have the ball carrier dodging with their eyes on the backside or on the skip lane instead of on the net? And it just seems like Virginia, in a game where, shockingly, the story of this game to me has been, how are your playmakers going to make plays when nobody can stay on their feet and they're playing, as Larkin put it, in an ice rink? Insane that they came to a slippery field ready to try and make individuals roll back, you know, do hitches, splits, whatever it might be. Kind of an insane lack of adjustment from a Virginia offense that we've seen been able to hit those backside and skip pass opportunities.
Well, Nick, one of the things that you missed that is absolutely worth calling out was the sequence at the end of the first half when Georgetown was down two with about a minute to go, scored, then won the faceoff, called timeout with about 33, 34 seconds left in the huddle. Kark was talking about playing for one. They go fast, they score inside of 10 seconds, win the faceoff again, call timeout again, sideline out of bounds again, Liam Connor not involved, Georgetown gets another goal, and now they're leading going into half with all the momentum. It was absolutely pristine from a coaching standpoint, and no doubt turned this game and was a huge factor in the outcome. All right, we got 25 seconds left in this one. It's a four-goal game. I think we can pretty much call it wraps. We'll probably revisit it once or twice more as it goes on, particularly in the context of talking about how the Hoyas advance to take on the Blue Devils. But let's go to Ithaca, where I didn't know that we were going to be able to top this one. It was the third game on Saturday, and I struggle because I don't want to just isolate the last, call it, 1 minute of regulation and three-ish minutes of overtime, but there's nowhere else to start. For me, this game came down to Matt Tully making outrageous saves versus Johns Hopkins picking up outrageous ground balls. If you have not seen the clip of Luke Martin sliding in front of Willem Firth, picking up a one-handed long pull ground ball, getting to his feet only for Firth to push him in the back and draw the flag. I can't recall whether it was technically a man up when Hopkins scored, but Cornell never got the ball back, and that was the game winner, as Matt Collison, who had on a couple occasions, both in regulation and in overtime, tried to recreate his clutchness, turned into the facilitator, and ended up finding space on the interior for Jimmy Ayers to finish with a dunk, and it was an unbelievable sequence of events. Larkin, your thoughts on this one as a guy who has had his eye on the Big Red all year long.
There's a lot to digest here. So remember, I mean, they hadn't played since 87. Cornell's a very hard place to travel to. There's something about that bus ride and the hotels there that, for whatever reason, like, it is a true home field advantage. I was not shocked that Cornell controlled the pace early and kind of built the lead. I thought Pete and his staff deserve a ton of credit of honestly, like, simplifying their halftime adjustments. To me, at least, I think what they said in that staff huddle was, we are not going to have a possession in the third quarter where Collison does not, like, initiate to start the possession. Like, we are going to get back to the basics of our best athlete dodging downhill, spin it through X, and find a way to create space and lengthen slides. And then you started to see leverage, and you started to see great opportunities. And to Cornell goaltender credit, he did a great job of digging in foxhole mentality and trying to give his offense more opportunities. I'm a defender. Everyone's heard me complain about runout decisions. This game will forever be stained for me because of the near side refs, the two possession backups that he gave to Hop late. I thought both should have gone white. With all of that said,
the one that Staub was super upset about, I would like to get the ref's explanation, because it seemed to me like he was telling him that he stepped out of bounds before the ball went out of bounds, which right. would be a plausible explanation.
Agreed. I slowed it down. I don't have like a microscope. I can't go, you know, full like replay version, but correct. If that is right, that's fine. But the other guy was out of bounds too, so the actual yes. explanation would have had to have been that the third guy was closest, and I don't know if that's right.
The other one that you're pointing to is correct, and also Charlie Eiler's hand was in the crease.
Right. So it's but it's a good example. Like tournament ball, especially late, it's like the levee during Katrina. I use that metaphor all the time. It just felt like Hopkins was sledding downhill in that fourth quarter, and. You know, Cornell did everything possible to extend the game. They really did. Like, they grinded. That's championship culture up there. Buse does a really good job. This was a team that I thought he took further than I anticipated. You know, he earned a home game. That's a really tough matchup, obviously. It's Hopkins. Everyone knows I'm critical at times. Like, it's Johns Hopkins. Like they're really athletic. They're talented. It's no different than drawing a Duke or whoever. So this is exactly why our tournament's so great. Anytime the 6-7-8 matchup, without fail, is going to be like can't miss television. Like, and when you add in the fact that Millman left Cornell for Hop and all that went into that decision, you know, he had an undefeated team at the time to remind people. I mean, there's a lot of juice in that room. Like, people got to understand these are two staffs that pretended not to know each other really well. They know each other really well. Connor Busick, no one even talks about him the way if he doesn't get that opportunity because Pete takes that job, right? Like, this is a good example of, you know, the reality of sport. And, yeah, so Cornell will be back. That, you know, it's championship culture up there. They'll be back.
One of the things that was interesting to me, two points that Larkin made. One I'll agree with, one I'll expand upon. Cornell has a true home field advantage just by the logistics of getting there. Like, it is, you are in the middle of nowhere, Forestville, and then you pull up to their campus. So the logistics of that, and I never played there, but Air Force had a game at Cornell in February when it was like pissing sleet from the sky. And we showed up on the bus and I was like, oh, we're in trouble. This was a disaster getting here. So, you know, some home field advantages are from the crowd. Cornell's is from the logistics of getting to campus. Unique brand of home field advantage. The second point, and this is what impressed me most about Hopkins, Larkin, you mentioned the halftime adjustment of just saying, hey, we have a guy who's better than everyone. Let's just make him initiate every single time. Was the right halftime adjustment. Like, live or die by the athletes that you've brought in and elevated to a status where they have the confidence. But the step further that I would take was when you're playing a hot goalie, It's such an easy trope for a coach to say, and from the coach's perspective, I wouldn't be surprised if Milliman and the rest of the staff was saying, we are getting good looks, continue to do what we're doing. Easy for a coach to say, but the player perspective on when you're running into a hot goalie is night and day, and you can try and convince yourself hey, we're getting good looks. They are going to fall. But when that hot goalie makes his third, fourth, fifth save in a row on your best shooters in their best situations, you kind of start to doubt if that game plan that's getting you the opportunities is going to work. You kind of start to ask yourself questions. How are we going to attack this defense to get even better looks at this goalie? And then you find yourself in this kind of weird position where you're passing up great shots to try and find an impossibly good shot that would be unsustainable. So the big takeaway for me was credit to Hopkins' maturity for that player buy-in of saying, we're getting good looks and we're running into a hot goalie. Let's not change anything. Let's not try to be more heroic. Let's not try to, when I'm shooting and the goalie's hot, I'm kind of side-eyeing, is there another passing lane? And then my shot value decreases. You know, going to be a fantastic matchup against Notre Dame. I'm excited to see the athletic Hopkins offense go against Notre Dame's D. That should be a really fun matchup. But the maturity of Hopkins' offense to keep going against a brick wall, not every team can do that. And for them to do that for two quarters and change coming out of the break, to me, was a difference maker.
So you guys pointed to the halftime adjustments, and that's well and good. And I think there was one in particular that I'm going to call out. But in general, for me, this was a coaching win. And the reason I feel that way is because you lose your solo captain, arguably best defender. I disagree that he's their best cover guy. I have disagreed with that for the last two-thirds of the season. I think Carson Brown has very clearly been Hopkins' best on-ball defender, and then for whatever reason on Saturday, it turned out that Luke Martin was their best ball cover defender as he caused five turnovers and picked up five ground balls. But it was so I think that's where it starts, because number one, the cohesion of their defensive game plan in terms of how buttoned up they were off ball, how many deflections they had, both on shots and on passes, was, I think, the starting point. It's incredible that they were able to hold Cornell to eight goals while making just three saves. The Big Red got 11 shots on goal. That is insane. The second side of this, in the halftime adjustment that I'll point to, is at the faceoff X, where Hopkins won just one of 10 draws in the first half, and then won, I believe, seven of 10 in the second half, including the faceoff in overtime. An incredible turnaround, and a lot of credit to John Cohen and that room for the overall preparation, and Joe Hobot for being able to devise the plan that went into effect. But for me, the main thing was the pace. I felt like Cornell was very insistent is probably too strong of a word, but they knew that they were going to be more comfortable playing faster than Hopkins would be. And so as a result, they wanted to play faster, and they were comfortable with the mistakes that came along with that, whether those were failed clears and turnovers in the clearing game or more aggressive skip passes in the offensive zone. And that goes back to some of the things that we were talking about in terms of the deflections and other elements of Johns Hopkins' buttoned up defense. But Hopkins' commitment to running the shot clock down and slowing the pace down, especially when they fell behind, was so impressive because of the belief and faith that it suggested that they had, that there was going to be enough time to come back. And then once you started to see it manifest, I don't know that I necessarily saw fatigue in terms of the way in which Cornell's defensive personnel was reacting on and off ball. It wasn't like you were seeing a lot of slumped shoulders, hands on hips, all that sort of stuff. But at the same time, you know, there were more seams, more creases, bigger passing lanes than there were early in the game. And ultimately, that was a big part of what Hopkins was able to take advantage of. And so I look at it, and when it comes down to it, again, the hustle. I mean, if there is one thing that Cornell is known for, it's their physical conditioning. If there are two things that Cornell is known for, it's their physical conditioning and their hustle. And I don't think there's another way to describe it. Johns Hopkins out-hustled Cornell on aggregate, and especially over the course of the last 8 minutes of the game. And Pete Milliman, this was my favorite part of the whole thing. So Christian Sweezy knows Cornell. I mean, he's literally written the book. And now, as of like yesterday when his second book came out, he has written two books about Cornell lacrosse. And he wrote the post-game story. He was there for us. And the first anecdote that was really interesting was the locker room, the visiting locker room in Larkin, you can speak to this because you've been in it, and maybe you did too, Nick. I don't know if you guys got dressed on the bus and just walked straight out onto the field. But the visiting locker room, it sounds like it's pretty far away, but the hotel is really close. It's not the hotel that they were assigned to stay at. So Pete switched the hotel to stay at the on-campus hotel, which is where they got dressed, and then they walked straight across to the game. But then that is not as juicy as this. So in the Ivy League championship, Princeton's goal song was, "Hey, baby, ooh,
ooh.
I wanna know, will you be my girl?" And it was wild because when that became Hopkins' goal song, very notably contrasted against Freebird, which for now a couple seasons has been Cornell's goal song, I was like, is that like a chirp? Is that like a, are they trying to demean Hopkins with that goal song? Oh, no, 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 no. It turns out this was a tactic. This was a twist of the knife. This was a Johns Hopkins watching film of the Ivy League championship, heard that song 19 times per, like 19 times per every time they watched the game, which you can imagine was more than once. So they got pretty used to that one and decided that Cornell probably was too, and that they were going to spice it up a little bit. And that was their goal song. And I, the overwhelming reaction that I got to the tweet that I put out about that last night was the people love that pettiness. Larkin, your thoughts?
I love it. Pavlov's dog. Like it, I actually didn't know Millman had that game in him, but now that I do, a little more respect in the tool belt from my side. Like that is a full blown psychotic thing to do in a good way. That's what sports are all about. You know, this is a school that he made a decision in the night to leave. There's bad blood on both sides. Like I can speak to that personally. I was the captain of a Division I lacrosse team whose coaches left in the middle of the night in the June of 2016, right? To the team that we just watched lose. So listen, this is one, it must have felt so good. When he had that victory beer on the bus or wherever he had it, it must have felt really good for him and that staff. And I know his coordinators were probably grinding for him for it. But yeah, no, it and by the way, great coverage by Sweezy to uncover that. That's an amazing, amazing fact.
Nick,
so it's funny when you get to see kind of the projection of your coach's maturity that he always takes with your team. You just see those cracks in the dam and some of the water to come through. I loved it in particular with Coach Corrigan, who would always say, and I've talked about it, a good amount, but in particular against Virginia and service academies. You know, he'd be like, we show these guys respect. You know, when the clocks hit zero, there's no more BS after that. And we're like, okay, coach, but, you know, the guy did just on Mother's Day, I'm telling this story, this guy from Air Force did just say a lot of things about my mother. I'm just supposed to keep my mouth shut. There's a difference from the boys in Iraq versus this guy who's his dad's a hedge fund manager and he just wants to, you know, play lacrosse at the Air Force Academy. No disrespect to any of the cadets. I just wanted to yap back. And there were a couple teams, you know, we're getting ready for DU. And I know Tierney and Corrigan were going to get red in the face on the sidelines. And at some point, you know, there would just be this, you know what, guys, let's take it to them. And I'm like, he said, you know, that's my version of the PG podcast. Let's take it to them. In reality, he was like, you know what? F these guys, you know, let's go win this game. And you kind of got to see that emotion come out. And it got all of us so fired up. So I would assume when Milliman was like, huh, interesting that this is the song that they heard 19 times. Boys, what do you think about this being our goal song? Honestly, as a player, I always hustled a little harder and played a little bit harder and emptied the tank to negative 10%. When I saw Corrigan get a little pissed, when I saw Corrigan get a little, you know, MF in the huddle. So, you know what? Every coaching decision matters, and whether it affected everybody on the roster, whether it affected one guy who got that extra ground ball, 4D galaxy brain chess move, and, You know, if they weren't going up against Notre Dame, I would say that that story alone would make me want to see them advance.
Larkin, we've been recording for 38 minutes, which means that you have been waiting 38 minutes to get this takeoff. Should Richmond have had to play Duke at home?
Of course not. It's a disgrace. It makes me so upset. People don't understand, okay? The criteria of the committee allows for subjectivity. They quite literally have a bullet at the bottom of their selection criteria, which opens the door, this concept of locations of contest, which effectively is like mitigate costs, okay? What that does is it creates the opportunity to intentionally misseed. There is no argument for Virginia having a stronger resume, in my opinion, than Syracuse. You could say those two teams were misseeded. You could say Richmond and UNC were misseeded. But most importantly, the lacrosse minds in that room, including men who've been Division I coaches, okay, could have raised their hand and said, hey ladies, hey Donna, here's a school from a non-traditional conference that raised a ton of money that's acting as the literal exact example of lacrosse can be a developmental sport. It can be positive for fundraising. You can have a record-setting crowd at the stadium on Saturday night, right? That ultimately is a good thing for the brand of the school. Instead, what? We give UNC the three lines so that they can beat the wheels off Albany, rest their first-team All-American attackman, and head to the quarterfinals? Both things can be true. You can say, hey, the bracket sucked, and all the coach nonsense in my DMs of like, well, you got to beat the team in front of you, and well, Duke was the last team in, and well, this, that, the other. That has nothing to do with anything. We as a sport want the regular season to matter. We want earning a resume that can avoid an ACC clamper and ACC athletes in the first round to matter. It has no relevance. Like there are many, many times that the third best team in the SEC West, to use a football example that all of our listeners will understand, would go undefeated in the Big 12 or the former Pac-12. Undefeated, right? Duke is really good. Duke has the number one overall pick. Duke in a bar fight probably beats the wheels off of every team in the country. They're big, they're long, they're five stars, okay? That is not a team that you should send to the four seed, in my opinion. We could have sent Army there. We could have sent Georgetown there, okay? And on top of that, we do it in a year where this coaching staff and the senior class were like the darlings of the entire story. We have subjectivity as a literal bullet point. I mean, it honestly makes me sick. I'm not shocked at all Duke won. The second the bracket came out, I was like, oh no, what a bummer, because Richmond's not going to make the quarterfinal. It was a hell of a game. We're about to talk about it. But just to get that off my chest, like, I don't really understand why both things, why we can't hold the committee more accountable to the things that should matter, while also saying, okay, now that we're in the dance, like, everyone's got to go win the games. It's all possible.
Well, so it's the worst thing that's happened since 2022 Notre Dame snub. And I started to recognize the gravity of it, because the unsung hero of this weekend to me was the audio tech on the production team for the Richmond stream. Of all the games when Richmond scored or especially won a faceoff in the second half, the pop from the crowd was they were top tier. And then there's Mount Everest to where we can discuss any pops or any crowds from the other games. This could have been such a defining moment to get Richmond lacrosse fans excited about next year, watching and, you know, boosting the ratings of, you know, whatever quarterfinal matchup. I was really bummed. I was pulling for Richmond. I'll just say, yep. I'll vote yay for Larkin's point.
So as far as the game goes, well, actually, as far as putting some specifics to the point that Nick just made, 6,805 fans in Robbins Stadium under the lights, biggest crowd ever for a first-round NCAA tournament game, which, with the 4,000 fans that were in the JMA Wireless Dome, suggests that this was probably the best-attended first-round game or first round of an NCAA tournament. I haven't seen the number from Klockner. I imagine it was pretty good based on what I saw on the broadcast. As the game goes, it was pretty slow to start, I thought. The thing that emerged the most was, all season long, we've talked about how reliant Duke has been offensively on Ben Johnson and Max Sloat, and that was not the case. The whole notion of who the Blue Devils could become was going to rely on the emergence of guys like Liam Curtius, who started to begin the season last year as a freshman, guys like Anthony Drago and Brady Scialetti and Michael Ortlieb, freshman attackmen slash midfielders who certainly are really talented and had the opportunity to contribute. Somebody like Tomas Delgado, who hasn't had the level of production that you would have projected from him coming out of high school. He scored with 2 seconds to go in the first half, felt a little bit like a dagger, turned a one-goal game into a two-goal game at halftime. Kershaw scores coming out of the half, and then the game completely flips. Gavin Creo scored, and at that point, you know, started. They had talked about the Ravioli story at this point a few times on the broadcast, and I think that might have been when Ravioli Prince became a thing. The Spiders then go on to score 8 of the game's next 12 goals to take a 12-9 lead with 11:22 to go. Gavin Creo had scored the last two goals, the last two goals of that run, the first two goals of the fourth quarter. But we would be remiss not to talk about Nate Murphy, the Richmond defenseman who is starting in place of Michael Farrell, who tore his ACL against High Point 3 games ago. He's their second best defenseman. Picks up a loose ball, throws it 80 yards. Aiden O'Neill catches it, hitches, gets to the middle of the field, and throws an absolute dart at the back of the net to score with 1 second to go. Unbelievable job by Drew Carter, who I think, and I called, so Larkin, you might remember this. Drew Carter called the Brown Virginia NCAA tournament game in 2022. And I remember texting my ESPN producer friend, and I was like, this guy is a budding star. He's incredible. He has gone on to become the lead voice for the Boston Celtics. So clearly, I am not alone in that opinion. And he immediately pulls out the Christian Laettner reference when it comes to the Murphy to O'Neill goal. And it was absolutely perfect. It was an unbelievably apt characterization and comparison. But then for reasons that still surpass understanding, the game just flipped. And that was Richmond's last goal. 11:22 to go in the fourth quarter. And just, you've used the analogy of the levees bursting, and it didn't necessarily feel like that, except that you know how in movies when a dam breaks, you see the crack first and the water starts to flow through and it has this like ominous vibe? Ben Johnson scored to make it 12-10. It was like, okay, they can recover from that. Then Ortlieb finds Papendick. Then Curtius finds Johnston. Now all of a sudden it's tied 12-12. But there's still 6 minutes to go. And you're like, they're going to be able to figure this out. Game goes scoreless for 4 minutes. Kyle Colsey, unassisted, 13-12. And then McGuire from Christmas in transition to seal it with a minute to go. And that was it. Does anybody have any explanation for why Richmond's offense went so cold in the last 10 minutes?
I actually want to kind of flip it. I'll answer your question in a different way. I thought that Richmond's poles did a phenomenal job through three quarters of holding up on ball. They forced the fifth and sixth dynamic Dodgers, such as Colsey as an example, or whoever was getting shortied, to have to try and penetrate. I thought Johnson was the disruption. And what I mean by that is he started going hard. And because of that, I think that Richmond perhaps overthought the amount of hedge help they would start showing to their poles. And because of that, slides got lengthened and then seams opened up inside. So I actually, the fourth quarter, I would just describe as Ben Johnson being a dude. Like this reminded me, because I think very highly of the kid covering him. I thought he hit the film was fantastic. Both sides, close defensemen, film was fantastic all day. Charlie Johnson on O'Neill. And is it Smith? Is that right?
Yes, Hunter Smith.
On Ben Johnson. Really good. High-level film. So I want to give Duke's O a little more credit, specifically 19. But yeah, I mean, guys, the number one overall pick got, like, shredded through two quarters. Like, the Richmond O's did a hell of a job, man. Like, Creo was going hard.
Joe Sheridan was going hard.
Who's that? The kid with not that many stats who had a couple of goals, one on the inside roll, crease finish. Really good. Picard was dodging really aggressively. This actually, to me, I think Osello will probably agree, reminded me of a professional lacrosse game. Like the poles kind of held up on ball, and this was old school phone booth, the O-mid's got to beat a short stick and got to find a way to get this defense spinning. And Richmond just didn't get the rock enough, but we're doing fantastic through 45 minutes. And, you know, eventually I think the wear and tear on the backside with Richmond and the emotion of the game started probably to take hold of the burden of it, on some of their rope unit. You know, the truth of this is what you receive when you get an away underdog ACC team is you almost always get a high-level clamper whose stats have been heavily watered down because of the quality of competition on his schedule. Like, Brady Wambach is fantastic. Notre Dame's clamper is fantastic. Okay?
John Mullen.
Duke's kid is probably really good. And if Duke's kid was, like, at an Ivy League school or was in the Patriot League, he'd probably be, like, 80% and be, like, an absolute freak that everyone knows about. So this is back to why my frustration with the committee. It's like, yeah, man, this is the ACC. There's only, like, six clampers a class. John Donowski gets one of them. They probably got a guy who can clamp. You know what I mean?
Well, and what's interesting about Cal Girard is that I think he was probably best known as being at the front end of what I would characterize as the next generation of faceoff guys, where it's not as much about the technical clamping as it is about what you do when you're on your feet and all of the other lacrosse skills that he has. But when I really started to focus on the actual faceoffs in this particular game, his hands were so quick. He lost so few clamps, and it was just the pressure that put on Richmond was incredible. And
wings weren't even involved, by the way. Winning
totally,
straight,
yeah,
to
he
himself,
did a great job of eliminating the wings
because Richmond's poles are pretty good, I think, in terms of mucking it up.
Well, that was where I wanted to go next, which was 91, Braden Pennefeather Stevenson, and I had him as my second team All American long stick, which I've made this point three or four times on the podcast already this year. My issue with analyzing Richmond personnel over the last couple seasons was been the homogeny. And this year it was the opposite of that. It was kind of like Princeton insofar as like it felt like every individual player popped. And I've really fallen in love with 91's game, especially. I mean, he made two game-saving plays in the A-10 championship in the last 5 to 10 seconds of the play on a crease collapse and a great ground ball in order to prevent St. Joe's from getting an opportunity to extend that game. And that was a microcosm of what he's done a lot over the course of the season. I thought he played really well against Duke as well, but I just thought that, your point is well taken in terms of the amount of pressure that they put on. Nick, what's your opinion on the committee?
I eternally will hate the committee, and I agree with Larkin on every point because I default to Richmond – and their game plan did everything right. And as I, now that the weekend is wrapped up and you can, and I hate that I'm borrowing Larkin's term, let's index some stocks here. I'm buying Yale, and I did not think Duke had you take away their two or three best offensive players, you win the game. And they proved that wasn't the case. I thought that was a huge feather in the cap of Duke to say, we do have the depth that maybe hasn't been exhibited at any point this season. But you take away our best guys, we still have some playmakers. And to Larkin's point, it felt a lot more like a professional game that both sides agreed to. And the depth of an ACC team will win, but it took every ounce that Richmond, every ounce that Duke had to overcome what Richmond threw at them. You asked me about the committee. I think Richmond wins just about every other game except for Duke with the style of play, how the matchups happened. I think that Richmond's style mirrors Duke's, and they win every other game except for maybe Notre Dame, Virginia, Duke. So it was just kind of a bummer that we don't get to see how this would match up against a Georgetown. I would love to see what Richmond could do against Princeton's offense. I would love to see some of these hypothetical matchups. And it's just a bummer that we don't get that. And I'm mad at the committee for that. I don't have much more on the analysis point, but really fun. Larkin's raising his hand.
The last thing on this piece, like the typical darling – the easiest out for the committee is that their schedule isn't good enough. They didn't do enough to play the right teams. Dan Chiamatti did everything imaginable to make this year's schedule hard enough so that bullet wouldn't be like the out or the caveat for Donna, right? They go to Chicago to play Notre Dame. Maryland cancels on them, right? Because of the cold, right? They play Virginia every year. They play Cornell this year. They scheduled that specifically to align this senior class. They played Georgetown, okay? Like, Dan knows his conference schedule isn't that good. He knows that people can pound the table on the RPI and the SOS and all these different things. So it's gutting, man. It's gutting. Like, you want to have a path for, Cinderella is not the right term. This is a super talented team. But, like, you want to have a path for a program to look at making an investment in lacrosse, to increasing the budget, to paying for Dan Chamati to not listen to the pen job. Okay, guys, this is like a decision that AD and that school made to support the staff. The coordinators are getting paid well. They're not leaving. There's been, you know, staff continuity.
Okay? Paul Richard's been there since day one.
Correct. Been there since day one. Like, I don't know, man. Are we going to reward like Bresch and UNC? Last time I checked, Duke beat the wheels off UNC like 6 days before the bracket came out. Like, maybe someone should have the nuts to raise their hand and be like, I don't know, boys. Like, maybe we put Richmond on the three line. Maybe we put them on the three line, right? We give them Albany. I don't know.
I think the bummer, too, and Larkin, I'm going to say a quote. You tell me who said it. You show me the incentives, I'll show you the outcome.
Right.
Charlie Munger. Maybe you've heard of him. Greatest investor of all time. This was a bastardization and a rewarding of bad incentives because – Duke cakewalked into the ACC. Richmond stacked their schedule with objectively really fun and entertaining matchups, and were rewarding the patsy schedule that an ACC team took, and I would say punished a prototype for what a lot of other programs are aspiring to become. So I think the fact that they got rewarded with Duke was not just an egregious bastardization to what Richmond has accomplished, but it was rewarding a really bad way to approach the season. And worst case scenario is other ACC teams and other big conferences just say, okay, well, if Duke got in and got Richmond, well, then why would we have really fun and interesting matchups in February and March? I don't think that's going to happen, but you know, in this day and age and in this administration, Terry, nothing's out of play.
I just want to pause and say that I've been doing this podcast with Nick for either 4 or 5 years, and Larkin joined us. This is the conclusion or nearing the end of the second season, and Nick's like full transformation into a Larkin-esque thinker / speaker is nearly complete. I would have guessed that it was going to take at least 2 more years. I am really shocked.
You're only as good as the people you surround yourself with. Thank you, Larkin. I'm elevating to bigger thinking, and I'm trying to get Larkin to be a little more personable.
I don't think people realize he's going to be a married man.
Berkshire Hathaway shareholder meeting is the day the committee comes out.
Yeah, like, for sure. I knew that as well.
Money.
Larkin, do you own any property, or is that just me? Move to Boise. Join the promised land of affordable real estate.
All right. We got to talk about Penn State 10, Army 6. You know, I had bought a lot of Army stock over the course of the last 3 weeks. And, you know, unfortunately, I feel like the nicest thing I can say about that performance was this is what we complained the last 2 years about you not getting in order to see. We didn't really talk enough about the sloppiness in Cornell Hopkins. I mean, the ball was ping-ponging all over the middle of the field. And when Army took the field at Panzer, we had just seen Albany throw the ball all over Dorrance. And the Black Knights, it kind of made it seem like, oh no, is this thing where the non-power conference teams have to level up in competition? And whether it's gripping the stick or the amount of pressure that you're under because of the athleticism on the other end of the field, it manifests in the ball going every which way. I felt like they settled down a little bit on that. And when you look at the box score, there's one number that stands out. I think Evan Plunkett was the best middie in the country all year long. I think he is the purest midfielder that we've had in college lacrosse in the last few seasons in terms of his offensive prowess, in addition to his ability to do everything. He finished with one goal, one assist, and seven turnovers. And what's interesting is I don't attribute his seven turnovers to the sloppiness that I just described. I think he found himself in a situation where he felt like his teammates weren't rising to the level, and he tried to do it all himself. And that was what was leading to a lot of those really, really forced attempt for offensive creation that just didn't come to fruition. And at the other end of the field, it was a to say coming out party is to be disrespectful of the performances that they put in the last couple of weeks. Obviously, there's a lot of attention on Hunter Aquino. There was questions as to whether he was going to play because of the end of the Hopkins Big Ten Championship game. He did. He played pretty well. But Andrew Beard was the separating factor. You know, he's a kid who has had just other level athleticism in terms of separation speed. His ability to S-dodge and get underneath his defender and then just finish with his toes on the crease feels like something that you just don't see in college lacrosse. And, you know, they only scored 10 goals. Michael Ferrone pretty well. Janju Considine had his hand in a couple of goals. There's still more in what Penn State can do, but ultimately just, you know, kind of an all-around thorough win. Either you guys got anything on this one?
Yeah, am I going to have to take the low-hanging fruit joke here? Because you kind of missed an easy layup.
Let me hear it.
First time we've seen Army lose to Panzers in a while, or something along those lines. I kind of thought you were going to tee that up, but...
Good job.
Anyways, yeah, Larkin, go ahead.
I think
also, Sean Bird made 20 Army saves. Loses had the potential to be Panzer. Way worse.
No, I think everything did, Terry said to set the table is correct. Like, I didn't think that Army was particularly prepared to play. I thought his teammates put Plunkett in an impossible situation. I also just think as a call-out, like, the Patriot League perhaps wasn't that strong at the top of the table this year. And, like, this isn't typically perhaps an Army team that would have won that league. And I think we saw that when Lehigh beat BU and created the entire scramble that was Duke's window to get in, right? So I do think, just as a call out, I thought Penn State was misseeded. Like, I think they're a lot better than Cornell and frankly beat the brakes off Cornell at home. And Princeton earns the one seed and now gets a really challenging matchup against a team that's already beat them this year. Penn State's kind of had this bizarre, like, roller coaster, but their quality film, like, when they're going, is really good. And they beat up on Hop in the Big Ten final, and it seems that they're getting healthier, Aquino in particular. And honestly, let's just give credit, man. Like, that staff is a tournament staff, like, no different than a Tillman or a Warner or whoever. You know, when push comes to shove in May, like, Tambroni is hyper-prepared, and they're not going to beat themselves. They're long. You know, they're athletic, and Princeton's going to have their hands full.
Let's finish it up with the first two games on Sunday. It opened up with Notre Dame 18, Jacksonville 5. This is a game that you're going to have to take my word for it was closer than the score would indicate, particularly because I believe Jacksonville hit two or three pipes early, and ultimately Thomas Richardelli, who was my first team All-American this season. Larkin, you called it out a couple weeks ago, the Lax reference stat about, or graph, line graph, about how much he had performed above expectation over the course of basically mid-March through late April was just eye-popping and totally confirmed what I had seen. It was, you know, interesting that obviously he then had his worst game, I think, of the season, but if not of the season, then in a very long time in the ACC semifinal loss, but totally redeemed himself with an incredible performance, 83% save percentage against the Dolphins. So, you know, it was 5-1 after one, it was 9-1 at halftime. I felt like Notre Dame did a really nice job offensively in transition. Thomas Perel scored the second goal on a fast break, and, you know, there was more than that as the first half went along. I thought Luke Miller showed both a lot of spunk, right? He got into a couple of defenders after he scored. He also made a defender fall down on a finalizer on the back of the net. He continues to emerge as, you know, a seemingly sixth Kavanaugh, fifth Kavanaugh. I lose track of how many Kavanaughs there are. actually are, but he definitely fits that mold. And the Irish advance comfortably. Nick, your thoughts?
As far as what you're putting on film heading into your next matchup, I don't think it could have gone better for what Hopkins needed to beat Cornell and how Notre Dame beat Jacksonville. Because this was, I thought, one of the most complete games that they played all season, particularly on the transition and offensive side. And now if you're Hopkins and you're looking at the full body of work, and obviously there are ways to put together a game plan that will limit, you know, it'll put a low ceiling on Notre Dame's offense, which we've seen a couple times throughout the season. But if you're Hopkins preparing for Notre Dame, you have to say we are going against an elite top two goalie, which we just, you know, had to go against in Cornell. So we're going against another great goalie. We're going against a stout defense. We're going against an offense in which, okay, yeah, we can put Luke Miller, Matt Jeffrey, you know, Josh Yago. Okay, maybe now there's – maybe we have to take away those three. But then there have been games in which Maharis has shown, you know, unbelievable ability to go and score three or four potentially. Like, it just seems like this game of whack-a-mole. Oh, now we have to limit Notre Dame's transition because they were really comfortable in transition. What this game meant to me was Hopkins has a monumental task of preparation. And where do you allocate those practice hours, and how do you put together a game plan that can limit what Notre Dame just put on film? It's certainly, you know, I think you can assume Hopkins short stick the middies would perform better. And in contrast to the Albany game that we talked, I did like that Jacksonville came out in the first quarter and just said, we're going to take it to you guys. We're going to, you know, compete our asses off. And they just ran into a really hot goaltender that kind of sealed the deal early into the second quarter, I would say. So moving past the Jacksonville game, loved the outcome of this because it made Hopkins' job that much more difficult. And we're on to the set our quarters. Let's go.
In the final first-round matchup.
No, let Larkin talk about Notre Dame real quick. Larkin, you think the Irish are taking it all this year?
I just wanted to give credit to Wardo. I thought he completely called out what the catalyst is for Notre Dame dogpile. Matt Jeffrey, it's like it breaks my brain that he only has like 20 points. Like, I think if he played at Brown, he'd have 100. So he literally has like Kyle Harrison left-right shake. There's no world in which a possession should ever start without him going a million miles an hour downhill.
The dodges that he bails out of are like, he's like, oh, I didn't like the stuff that I got there. I'm just going to pull this out and try again. I'm not exaggerating. Like, it would be, to say it'd be the most athletic thing that I would have ever done in my entire life is to just, It deserves to be laughed at because it is so far removed from any, like, the most athletic thing I've ever done.
Totally. I think that if he heats up, and by heat up, I don't mean, like, statistically. I just mean, can he draw, like, 30 slides in a semifinal game? That's, like, a great result for Notre Dame, and I don't think they can lose if he does that. And honestly, to hold Kevin Corrigan accountable, that dude is so fit. Like, run him out of the damn box every possession and let him dodge. Like, literally, let's not overthink this.
Like, by the way, we still haven't seen Dylan Faison invert. Princeton 17, Marist 8. I feel like this was actually a pretty similar game. What?
Are we going to talk about Kevin Corrigan's quote this week?
Great. What was your favorite part of it?
Just the fact that he's getting really comfortable. You know, he's been at the helm for so long, and he would say, you know, some – so he was Mr. Analogy, and he's always gone back to, you know, the old bull and the young calf and, you know, the scorpion and the frog. That's what he would say to the media. And now that I see him going, you know, it's kind of like pornography. And I'm like, Coach, I thought that one was kind of for the locker room, for the boys. But now that you're saying it to the media, to use the damn analogy we've used five or six times, I'm like, are you really going to flood the media with elite 30-year developed analogies that probably should stay in the locker room. But if you're letting the if you're letting the media have it, you should charge $5 an analogy, and you'll retire richer than you could expect.
So for those that didn't see it, he was talking to the media earlier this week and said he was asked about deflections, and he was talking about how it's harder to get deflections as a defender in lacrosse than it is in basketball because the ball is smaller, and then basically worked his way into you can't describe
invisible plays.
Invisible plays, but you know them when you see them. It's like pornography that way. But this is my favorite part. He then says, when it's done well, which is such an unbelievable implication that Kevin Corcoran has an opinion on the difference between well and poorly done pornography.
I mean, not to mention he literally coaches at Notre Dame. Like, is there like a priest who's emailing him this week? Does he have to go to like a seminar?
He'll probably have to go.
There's like conservative super PACs literally like emailing the school, and they're like so confused what's going on.
Coach Corrigan has been fined 10 Hail Marys and 30 Our Fathers.
Okay. He's going to have to go to mass before the quarterfinal.
Anyways, Princeton.
Princeton 17, Marist 8. And like I was saying, I feel like this game was actually really similar to the Notre Dame-Jacksonville game insofar as how really up for the competition Marist was, especially early. Jules Henningberg, and I believe, was he doing the game with, not Jay Alter, forgive me, Mike Corey, did a really nice job of highlighting how big Marist was and how willing they were to go toe-to-toe with the Herculean-esque defenders that Princeton brings to the table. And, you know, it was an 8-4 halftime score, and I think the difference between the Notre Dame Jacksonville game and the Marist Princeton game was, you know, the Jacksonville pipe shots went in for the Red Foxes. Drew Anderson and Peter Murray, Jace Conowitz did a really nice job. But ultimately, Nick Abiri, 3 goals, 5 assists, Chad Palumbo, 6-1, Colin Burns, 3-2, John Dunphy, 1-3. Tucker Wade, I think, had a little bit of a dagger to start the second half with an alley dodge. He finished with 2 goals. Quinn Kramer, Jules really got excited at one of his body checks, and Kramer finished with 2 as well. So again, for the Tigers, it's a win in advance situation, and they get a rematch against a team that beat them. So we're at 14-2 now for Princeton. So I guess that makes it 15 games ago, and they get another shot at the Nittany Lions. Larkin, your thoughts?
Yeah, it was business as usual. I mean, I think everyone's heard me say it this year, but Princeton makes the ball sing. They're absolutely loaded on offense. You know, they earn the right to be the one seed. So not at all shocked by the outcome. You know, check the box, do your job, and now it's, you know, they have a huge matchup against a really well-coached and talented team. But what Princeton has, which very few do, is there's no, like, personnel junk that you can throw at Princeton. They have 6 guys who can dodge hard, and they can generate effectively what they want to. So the path to beating them is with clamps, saves, and out-execution on the offensive side. But this idea that you're going to do what Kevin Warren did tonight to UVA, as an example, to Princeton, will not happen. Like, they move very well. The ball moves east-west. I mean, it's like music. Which is the highest compliment I can pay as a defensive player.
Princeton's offense, when they're firing, makes it look so easy. Elite level decision making as a starter, you know, as a starting point to that point. But the fact that 6 offensive players all have elite level decision making and the skills to back up and take advantage of the decision that the ball carrier made, in whether that's a pass down, pick down, whether that's initiating from X, from up top, skip passes, wing play. It's a thing of beauty. I would be remiss if I didn't say that the first quarter kind of excited me, because to me, the X factor, you know, Princeton's goaltender being a first team All-American, if he got cold, that game could have been really interesting. So credit to Marist for just saying, we're showing up and we're shooting, we're flying around, and we're making plays on offense. But yeah, first quarter, really exciting. Second quarter, the spark kind of faded, and then, you know, the inevitable happened. But I'm really interested to see how Penn State's offensive efficiency compares to Princeton, in this round, because to me, it's up to Penn State's offense to neutralize the 6-on-6 game as much as possible. Cause that, you know, you need to win on faceoffs and goaltending, as Larkin just said, but how much of that do you need to rely on? We'll see.
While we've been recording, we got our times for the quarterfinal matchups. We begin with Johns Hopkins versus Notre Dame at noon from Hempstead, New York, and follow up on Saturday at 2:30 with Carolina versus Syracuse. And then on Sunday, we get going with Penn State versus Princeton in the first game from University of Delaware in Newark, and finish the weekend with Duke versus Georgetown, a Hofstra reunion between Kevin Warren and John Donowski. Fellas, any thoughts on the quarterfinals before we depart?
I think every matchup is like can't miss television. There's so many great narratives still at play. In particular, when you think about, you know, the narrative arcs of Joe Bresci, of a Gary Gate, Spallina, etc. You know, can Corrigan do it again with the team many people thought wasn't talented enough offensively, right? You know, does Madelon reassert Princeton to the top of the table after the Tierney years? There's just a lot to like. I mean, I think as a lacrosse fan, I would just plead with you to, you know, now I need to look in the mirror on this, but avoid the tee times, avoid the beach and the pool, you know, get in the pickup truck and go have a few pints and support the sport. I mean, it's going to be great, man. I mean, this is everything you asked for.
My game I'll be watching closest is Penn State Princeton, because to me, it's, as we've talked about seemingly every episode this year, it's wide open except for Princeton. If Princeton can have a really good performance and win by a healthy margin against Penn State, that to me will say they're the team to beat in a wide open field. How do you beat Princeton? So that's the most intriguing matchup to me. And then, you know, backed up by an incredible slate. Don't avoid a tea time, but just make it at, you know, at sunrise. Get done. Come home with a buzz. Larkin, what's your handy right now?
Too high, brother. Can't make anything with my flatty. Hitting hard, though.
I'm 10 right now. I need to crack single digits. If I could read a putt, who knows? World's my oyster. But until that day, I'll see you out there on the links.
What a note to end on. If you like what you heard, tell a friend, leave a rating and review. Boys, we've only got a couple of these left. We'll be back next week with more Tailgate Podcast.
Love you, Terry. Love you, Larkin.